Hi everyone, welcome to the Corporate Chat podcast. Your hosts today are Émile Journet and myself, Cédric Nadeau. Émile and I study finance, both at McGill University. Special thanks to Red Bull for sponsoring the show. Our guests today are Max Lica and Mike Ferrino, the two co-founders of Kento Health. Kento Health is a digital health company using AI to provide personalized cardiac rehabilitation and healthcare through clinical exercise programs, coaching, and real-time monitoring. Prior to founding Kento, Mike and Max were both early employees of Dialogue Health Technologies, where Mike joined as head of finance and Max as VP operations. In this episode, Mike and Max share valuable insights on their work experiences, about starting a company, and about many more interesting topics. Without further ado, here's our conversation with Max Lica and Mike Ferrino.
Hi, Max. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the Corporate Chat podcast. How are you today?
Good, good. Pleasure to be here.
Hi. Hi, both. Glad to be here.
So, if we start an interview with your professional journeys, can you both tell us more about your background?
Max, you want to kick it off?
Sure. So, I went to B school in France, and then I spent a couple of years in Paris building a business in digital consulting for a French company. They sent me eventually to Quebec, where I built their subsidiary, did a couple acquisitions. Then I took a spin into strategy consulting, fantastic world, and then joined a very early stage digital health startup where I met Mike, and then eventually starting our current venture, which is Kento Health.
Yeah, and on my end, maybe a bit more prototypical of a person who was educated in Quebec and not necessarily in France, but did my studies at HEC, studied also in business and specialized a bit more in accounting, got my CPA title here in Canada, essentially, and started off my career a bit more, like I said, prototypically with regards to joined a big four firm, started off in audit, did my time in audit for about 2 years, all in all, over there was at Ernst & Young. And then after that, I switched right away pretty much onto the transactional side of things. So more M&A, business valuations, working on due diligence for acquisitions and stuff like that. That's really what I was passionate about. Got the chance to really travel and live abroad. So went all across the U.S. on different projects, lived in Los Angeles for about 2 years, lived in Europe, a mix of Amsterdam and Paris for about probably 6 months each, respectively, on different clients. So got really to touch a bit more on the transactional side of things. Took my first corporate non-consulting job at a company called McKesson. At the time, it was a Fortune 10 company, more specialized in healthcare, pharmaceuticals, distribution, all that good stuff. Joined as the person in charge of the M&A strategy and special projects for the Canadian division. We did many acquisitions, but some that maybe you would know of is, for example, the acquisition of Uniprix, that's well known here in Quebec. And essentially, when I was there, I got contacted by the digital health company that Max mentioned, which was Dialogue, a complete 180 versus McKesson. At the time, it was up-and-coming company with barely, call it, 6 months of runway, probably, when Max and I joined. We joined probably, early employees, scaled it up, and now it's definitely a great success story. Gave access to many people across the country to telemedicine services, and it went really well. And that's where I had the privilege of working with Max. And now we're on to our next adventure, which is also in the digital health space, called Kento Health.
And you mentioned earning your CPA and your CBV. How do you think these certifications help you throughout your career?
Yeah, thanks, Cedric. I forgot about the CBV. I hadn't mentioned that one, but it's true. CBV was definitely was helpful. The CPA as well. I mean, I think they're great tools to add to your toolbox. They're not necessarily a means to an end, but they're more there to help. So with regards to, CPA maybe is a bit more tailored if you stick, let's say, to audit, but it's still very helpful if you move over to more like transactional or strategic finance, because, you have some of the technical side of things locked down, right, with regards to understanding financials, understanding these things, doesn't necessarily help with some of the other aspects that you need also, which are maybe a bit more like on the negotiating front or on, you know, the people relations front, but it does definitely help on the technical side of things. And same thing with the CPV, it helps you, you know, better model synergies, better evaluate companies, especially if you're taking a more of a strategic finance approach to things.
Mike, you spoke about it a bit, but what exactly led you to the healthcare industry, right? You started in multiple roles in finance and consulting. What made you want to actually pursue something in healthcare?
Great question. Very transparently, I mean, when I was more on the consulting side of things, whether it was an audit or M&A or whatever, it was, you know, it was really industry agnostic, right? So I had companies that were in media and entertainment, I had other companies that built planes, some that were private equity funds that were just looking for massive returns. So it was a bit all over the place. McKesson was kind of my first dive into healthcare. It wasn't really digital health. It wasn't really anything innovative, but it was a massive player in the healthcare space. And I started to understand a little bit more how it works and some of the specificities related to healthcare. But I would say my interest really came from joining Dialogue, seeing the impact that we were making on certain people's lives, and just seeing the company grow and scale for a need that, you know, it is a pressing need here in Quebec, especially, you want to, most people don't have a family doctor. It takes you 15 hours if you go to the emergency. So it did answer a need. And just building a relationship with Mac, working with Max, so closely. And, you know, he was in charge of all the ops there. So he had like probably 3/4 of the company reporting to him, give or take, probably something along the lines of like 1,200 people. I was taking care of more of the back office, building up the finance function, fundraising, M&A, and all that stuff. We worked closely together, and we just realized that we needed to also build a venture where we could have a massive impact on people's lives, and healthcare is definitely a massive pillar of that.
Nice. And on your part, Max, you've launched and scaled Alten Canada. What sparked an interest for you in entrepreneurship?
Yeah. Go back to early childhood, I guess. And this is what my mom always told me. So when I was a kid, I would never sleep. So my parents would go nuts. And I was building Legos. So I had my box of Legos, and all night long, I would just be playing with that. And moving on to, you know, early days computer. I just turned 40, so bear with me. It's old age computer that I'm talking about. But I started playing strategy games on my computer. And I've been obsessed during my teenage years up to early university. I would just play hours and hours of strategy games. And I've always been, you know, a builder, liking to build long-term things, like have this helicopter vision. I played a lot of rugby for 15 years at a competitive level. And rugby is also a strategy game, right? So debatable in terms of you know, game logic, but it's still strategy, right? It's a violent strategy, but it's great strategy. And so all these things have compounded over the years into me wanting to always be building things. So when I started my first job, I was hired by this consulting company in Paris, and they said, look, we don't do anything for the financial insurance industry. Do you want to build out that practice for us? Like, absolutely. Pick up my phone, cold calling, no laptop till you're reached. I think it was 20 cold calls every day, and I had to generate 5 appointments per week. Otherwise, after a couple of weeks of non-hitting the targets, you would get fired, right? I built this practice up to 100 consultants, a couple millions in revenue. And so I really loved it. And I progressed very quickly in this company. And at some point they say, okay, we'll ship you to Canada. You'll do the same. Build out our Canadian operations. Here is 3 million, I think it was 2.5 or 3 million euros. Here is a check, go there, build this out, acquire companies if you need it, and let's see what you got. And so after 3 years, we built Alten Canada into a, I think when I left, it was a $20 million AR company with 2 acquisitions. And now it's much bigger. I think they're close to 1,000 people in the payroll. So it's a massive company that I still get to enjoy and cheering for on the sidelines. But yeah, I've always been a builder. And when I got this call in my consulting years, it was a bit frustrating for me. I love consulting from an intellectual process standpoint, but I wasn't really happy because you do a lot of conceptual stuff, but not a lot of execution stuff. And I'm a guy who needs this execution stuff. I need to go and roll out my ideas. So when I got this call from Anna, who's a co-founder at Dialogue, and say, hey, do you want to come here and build out operations for us in healthcare? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I want to build. And so we built this into this crazy success story that Dialogue has been under great leadership. And yeah, I think we had a few lessons with Mike, things we really loved the Dialogue that we wanted to build into our next venture, things we were not necessarily in agreement with that also we wanted to change a little bit in our next venture, and all these years of experience working together. And by the way, I was spending the money that he was raising and managing, so that we had to have sort of a close relationship together, which I still do, by the way. and yeah, that was I think building has always been what really drives me, right? I just build.
Yeah, it seems that that experience at Dialogue really taught you both a lot. What, from both of your perspectives, what do you guys learn from that experience, and how are you guys able to apply this at Kento?
Yeah, I'll maybe kick this one off. Quite honestly, quite a few things that at least me, that I personally learned from this experience, and I think some of them are going to resonate with Max also. You know, to Max's point just now about how consulting is a great, great, great school, and I completely agree with him. I think it's a fantastic school. You're surrounded by super intelligent people. You're really trying to solve some complex problems, whether it's on the strategy perspective, transaction perspective, like whatever. It's you're there to solve complicated problems that usually some of these massive companies can't solve themselves, and you're surrounded by a great team, but you never really see the execution of it play out. You're there, you structure the plan, you give them the plan, and you walk away. One of the things that I really learned at Dialogue is how key execution really is, coming more from a heavily consulting background before that, not necessarily having the building background that Max had, you know, building up division Alten in France, bringing it over to Canada and all that. So for me, it was really seeing how important execution truly is. You'll live or die by the execution at the end of the day. That was one. Second thing was just hyper growth. You think it looks fun from the sidelines. It's really, really tough to manage. And it also goes with, you know, it comes with the whole execution play and how important it is to be surrounded by really good people, smart people who can also execute properly. So those are some of the biggest learnings that I had at Dialogue. Yes, there's more technical ones, how to, you know, properly run fundraising processes with VCs, IPO processes, this and that. Yes, there's the technical, more textbook stuff, but it's really how important some of the relationships are and how important it is that, you know, you have an army ready to go to war, because hyper growth or hyper or even just, you know, potential bankruptcy is all about resistance, resilience, and working together as a team. So I think that's something that we learned quite a bit at Dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, copy paste what said Mike. It was really, for me, the going from a closet to this giant organization, especially running ops. Like, we started with 3 or 4 people, and then we just grew up into this massive care machine. And I think, at least when I left Dialogue, I think we're seeing close to 3,000 patients every day in a country that has a critical need for primary care and mental health services. So I think the impact is what, at the end of the day, you wake up for and you keep going, because you know you're delivering a mission that is truly important for people, and you save lives, and you see that you make a positive impact in people's life. And so it makes things a little easier. There's a silver lining on all the efforts we put in, but just, you know, building a structure that scales from virtually 10 people to 1,200 is completely incredible. So how do you think about hiring? How do you think about empowering your people? How do you think about building the processes and tools along the way so that you don't get lost into startup mode when you have 1,000 people, which doesn't work, right? So it's really scaling at the right pace. And also from a mindset perspective, I think it's the boldness it takes to get there. And you're being forced forward. And that's the big difference when you're building a startup, is that your only option is to move, right? Because just, you know, immobility is a failure. So we need to move forward and continue building and executing, to Mike's point. And that was really what we were forced to do at Dialogue. And it's a great school too, because, you know, you're, as Mike said, your runway has a certain lifespan, right? And before you hit that lifespan, well, you need to build the next thing that's gonna get you to the next step where you wanna be. So super interesting, both from a personal lesson perspective, but also, you know, building an organization, and our current venture Kento is not by anywhere close to that scale, but we're going back to early days, which is to me the least comfortable position, because you don't know what tomorrow is going to be, right? You're still looking for your clients, still looking for fundraising and everything. So it's not, you don't have a 3-year timeline in your strategy, right? You're much living day to day ish. But then it's an incredible way to foster resilience within a team. And the early days at a startup is the most fun part for me, because you're just like blank sheet. You can do whatever you want, just like a strategy game, right? If you play Roller Coaster Tycoon or whatever, you have a blank park and you can build whatever you want. And that's the fun part. And then when you grow, you just have to, you know, follow the direction, obviously, but it's super, I love going back to early day startup.
And talking about early days, you guys both mentioned you worked together at Dialogue, but how did you end up deciding to build a startup together?
We met at Dialogue. Funny enough, Max and I started the exact same day. I think I got in maybe 10 minutes earlier, so I'll say that I was the first to join between the two of us. But no, jokes aside, we started the exact same day. Max's role was really to build out the medical operation, some of the new products and all that, and really build the structure that, to his point, can scale, but also remain flexible with scale, with different products being added on. And I was hired more to another person that you had on this podcast not long ago. Guillaume Marion was the interim CFO until I joined, and really build up an in-house, finance team and back office team essentially there. So and worked with him quite a bit. He's a great person. So essentially, Max and I went to work together quite a bit. As he mentioned, I would raise some money. He would spend pretty much almost all of it or most of it. But all I'll say, we got a great working relationship together. And we would find, just going through it and seeing what a lot of patients would struggle with, etc., we would find certain gaps that are existing in the market. Max's family, my family as well, we didn't really win the genetic lottery also when it comes to cardiac disease. So we would talk about that quite a bit. And we'll see that it's a massive problem in the US. Essentially, it was just really through conversation and getting to know each other for many, many, many years, right? That we just one day started to think of how can we potentially solve really this massive, massive problem. And that's how we got to the idea of Kento, essentially, after many months of deliberation discussion. And then, by that point in time, we already had a working relationship together. We knew each other very well. We're friends, professionally, personally, et cetera. So it was only just the next natural step to continue together and to work together. But yeah, Max, I don't know if you want to touch in on anything more specifically.
We always say, don't build a company with your clone. And I think that's a perfect definition of what we have with Mike going on. It's Mike is the Excel guy. I'm the PowerPoint guy. And that sums a lot of our working relationship, what we're good at, where we position our strength. But we're also aware of how the other complements each other. So we're very open in the feedback we give each other, which was very important for me when I chose to build this company with Mike and vice versa. Like it's dating relationship, right? You need to be able to have this conversation, because if the person doesn't take your feedback properly, probably not the right person to marry, right? Because it's sort of a marriage. I spend more time with Mike than I probably do with my wife. So it's very important that this relationship works and is built on solid basis. And yeah, it was, Mike touched on it, but when we were building Kento early days, my mom had a heart attack. And the care she received after her heart attack was just terrible. She never really recovered from it. And so that became a personal mission. I think Mike and I, after our spin Dialogue, we were looking for something more personal. When you get to a certain point in life, maybe it's because that my 40th birthday is making me realize a lot of things, but you realize that you want to make a personal impact on what matters to your loved ones. And in my case, it was heart care. And it also happens to be, lucky enough or not, but the number one killer in the world. It's the biggest problem we have in the world. A third of the deaths are due to heart care or heart disease, should I say. And there's a big, big, big gap in terms of access and digital care in there. So all this coming together was sort of a no-brainer to build one in the space and two with Mike. And he touched on the market. The US market is obviously a very different beast than Canada, but we felt it was the best ground for us to build something that can scale fast so that we can then come back to Canada, because we still have, you know, Canada on the roadmap at some point. But just, you know, from a fundraising perspective, a risk aversion perspective, we thought, you know, US was a good territory for us to launch.
Max, you mentioned you're now spending more time with Mike than your own wife. I mean, and you guys have worked in finance roles and consulting roles. How has your work-life balance changed throughout the years?
You want me to kick this one off, Max? I mean, listen, let's be very honest, right? Like, in whether it was Max's consulting days or mine, even if they were in different branches, balance is a delicate word, right? I don't think there's much balance. And same thing if you've had investment bankers on here or, you know, anyways, essentially all this to say, balance is a very big word. I think you need to be, and this is just my opinion, right, guys? Like, don't take this for gospel, but I think you need to be out of balance when you want to, you know, to build something right now, whether it's early on trying to build up, you know, your career, and you're in consulting or whatever other field, you need to be out of balance quite a bit when you're building when you're part of a startup that's exploding, becomes a scale up and becomes a publicly traded company. Also, you need to be out of balance quite a bit. And right now, building this startup, we're also quite out of balance. So for me personally, it's been pretty much out of balance almost the entire time. You still, doesn't mean that you don't enjoy personal time, doesn't mean you don't enjoy family time, doesn't mean that you can't have a life outside of work, but balance is just a word that at least personally I have difficulty with. So, and once again, this is not gospel, but I think you do need to be out of balance when you're trying to build something.
Yeah, fair enough, Mike. I look at it a little bit differently. I think there's no such difference in 2024 between life and work, right? One is part of the other and vice versa. So even when you're at work and building your company, well, my kid still needs to see me, right? My wife went to the hospital last week and still, there's no other choice, right? So there's trade-offs certainly when you build where you need to dedicate your energy. Like, time is a finite amounts that you have. Every day you have 24 hours. So how do you split it? Personally, it's my sleep is very important. I need 7 to 7:30 hours of sleep that I get consistently. I'm an early to bed kind of guy. So I go to bed at 9:30, but I've been doing that my whole life. So I haven't changed. I've never been a big party dude or drinking a lot. And I've always been very good with my personal life hygiene. And the reason is I was doing competitive sports, you know, rugby at a very high level. So I had to I had no other choice, right? And I carried that over to my different professional lives. And still to that day, I have a little over an hour every morning, 8 to 9, don't book Max, right? It's my calendar, everyone knows it. I don't take meetings unless it's, you know, super important, critical. But every day I still work 6 to 7 times a week, workout, and the rest of the day obviously is dedicated to Kento and my family. But I have my protected personal time that keeps me balanced. But it's very important to protect this time from my perspective, because if I didn't have this hour for myself, and you know, when you work out, you also think about a lot of things. You have time for yourself. I love walking my dogs because I always get a bunch of ideas for Kento when I walk my dogs. You know, I'm on my own. I'm not scrolling through stupid social media. I'm just focused time, right? That's super important.
Very insightful. We'll now move on to our business segment. For those who are not familiar with Kento Health, how would you describe the business and its vision?
I'll kick it off. I'll give you my PowerPoint version. Mike will give you the Excel version of it. I think the biggest problems we're solving is twofold. heart disease or heart care is always delayed and reactive, which means that most people wait until they end up in an ER with a heart attack to say, oh, I may want to worry about my heart health, right? Shit, I might die. That's number one. And number two, I think it's also linked to the fact that it's delayed and the accessibility is terrible. So when you think about, you know, people who need to have access to heart disease, it's not when they're in the ER that it starts building in your 20s, right? So if you don't take care of your heart or at least raise awareness before you're 65, which is peak age to get a heart attack, it's already too late. So that's the big problems we're solving. One, delayed care, reactive, and then the accessibility. And so how do we solve it? So we developed, I use past tense, but we still are evolving the product. So we developed a platform, a heart disease management platform with Mayo Clinic, co-developed that. And so for a patient and a user, it's an app that does 24/7 monitoring of your heart rate, your blood pressure, sleep, activity. And we crunch all these numbers to catch problems early, right? And in addition to this data we capture, we combine it with one-on-one clinical coaching so that there's always someone watching you, right? So you're when you have heart disease, you need continuous care. That's exactly what we're bringing. And we build this on a clinical approach that is the gold standard in heart care, which is called cardiac rehab, right? And this program has amazing health outcomes that are documented. It's been around for a while, but we're digitizing it. And in order to make all this happen, we build sort of a proprietary AI that is able to crunch all these numbers, make predictions for the patient and the clinicians, deliver insights. And the end goal, because there's like hundreds of millions of people who would need our solutions because they have heart disease, is to be able to make predictions. So we want to be able to predict, Cedric or Emil, when we onboard you on Kento, based on what we measure in your medical history, we want to be able to say, okay, you're at higher risk of a heart attack in the next X days, Y months. So that's something that we really look at when we build our technology and clinical approach. Prediction is the key, right? We want to avoid people having to end up with a heart attack or a stroke, right? Go for it, Mike.
No, it's exactly that. I mean, there's not much to, yeah, there's not much to add with regards to this one. I mean, you know, not necessarily specific to cardiovascular disease, but, you know, living, for example, for most of us living here in Quebec, you could tell that any health system, right, is extremely reactive, very slow wait time. I mean, these are general problems that we see. It's just that they're heavily accentuated, though, when you are talking about cardiovascular disease, and especially in the U.S. And that's something that we're trying to, you know, trying to tackle and make a massive dent in.
We often hear there's a lot of challenges related to founding a business. What was the biggest challenge you both encountered, and how did you overcome it?
Having a co-founder from France is no, I'm kidding.
It's a bad one. I know.
Yeah. Just kidding. Listen, there's so many challenges. I mean, realistically, coming up with a problem that's already, you know, big enough and that you could actually make an impact in is difficult enough as it is, right? Especially in 2024, there's solutions for almost anything, for everything in your life. We're at a point where we can almost automate close to anything. So, I mean, it's definitely complicated with regards to that. But let's say you have your idea, you have a great partner to launch this business in, then comes the whole setting up the business, potentially fund, you know, are you going to be fundraising for it? Are you taking the VC route? Are you going to be bootstrapping it? Are you going to be putting is it a mix of, you know, your own capital and the rest? So it's essentially, you need to fund the business, you need to operate it, hiring, especially if you're dealing with a global problem and you want to bring it to a global stage, like where will you be hiring your people? You know, so there's a plethora of problems. The ones that I would focus on really is, the toughest ones are hiring the right people and the best people and for different stages. And it really changes by stage. I find, like, you know, you need you need people. When you're first starting off a business, it's not the same skill set as if you're, for example, a publicly traded company, right? So it's different skill set based on the stage of the company. But I think hiring the right team is always something that's very complicated. And essentially being sure that you could fund your idea up until it's, you know, growing by itself.
I'll just add something to the founding thing that I think is important for our auditors. One of the things that is very important when you launch a company is being able to convey your story in a way that people who are going to put money into your business understand what you're building is not a nice to have, it's a need to have. And so we spent, I think I built the whole team, when I say it's Kento, we built 450 slides in order to be able to extract the 10 power slides that we're bringing to our investors to say, okay, we've run this thing through in every possible direction. This is a story that is compelling that we need to tell. Shed all the unnecessary details and build a story that is compelling enough so people are going to put several millions into your business. This storytelling part is true for fundraising, to get your initial clients, to hire your first employees. And so the time spent on explaining, what we do is not super straightforward for someone who's not in the medical field, has been a lot of effort for us and a brain crunching exercise for sure.
Yeah, so I just wondered, how do you guys view the balance between growth versus share dilution?
I know share dilution is a very sensitive subject for, you know, many founders, many companies that take the VC route. But, you know, one thing that, you know, Max and I love to chat about is if you take an example of, I don't know, take Jeff Bezos. He owns, what, 5% of Amazon? He's still worth north of $200 billion. I mean, at the end of the day, I would prefer having 5% of one of the world's biggest pies over having 80 to 90% of, you know, la tarte au sucre from IGA, essentially. So it's just, you know, and maybe not the best parallel, right? But I'm just saying there.
Hope no one from IGA is listening.
Sorry, yes, guys. You need to. I never tried it, actually. It may be very good. But my whole point here is just, you know, you need to strike a balance. I think when it does come to fundraising and dilution, it's important not to go out there and try to raise funds from a vanity metrics perspective. And what I mean by this is, if you truly do the exercise properly and you realize that, I don't know, for example, you only need 2 million, put around number, 2 million to succeed over the next 24 months and then get a better valuation and, you know, play the VC game, essentially. Don't go out and raise 10 because it's cool to raise 10 and because you'll have a press release saying that, oh, we raised $10 million. Our last round was heavily oversubscribed and we refused to take on additional capital, even if, you know, because we truly did not need it, right? And okay, maybe it would have made a better press release to have twice the size of the round, but that's, you know, so there is a game to play and only raise what you truly need over the next 2 years. That is definitely easier said than done because there's always unexpected, there's different opportunities that come up, et cetera, but still, if it's a good opportunity and it's a good unexpected, you can always go out and raise more capital under better terms. So I think it's really just it's essentially a balancing act, going back to the balance topic.
Yeah, I think it's very important to look at it from the impact you want to make, right? So at Kento, we're building a product that can be delivered in any geography. So we're now deploying in the US, we're deploying in Asia early next year. So it is likely that Kento will be not I won't call it a mass market product, but used by a lot of people going forward. So to Mike's point, because we need to fund this growth to make the biggest impact possible, we're going to need capital. But it's capital we allocate for the growth of the business with a clear plan, clear milestone, and very diligently. If you just fundraise because, you know, someone is putting $20 million on the table, you're not sure what you're going to do with it, that's what you shouldn't be taking, right? So in our case, it's a bit different, but I think Mike, you know, sums it up perfectly when you say, you know, think about fundraising and don't do it for vanity purposes, because that's the worst thing you can do as a founder.
So at a stage where your business was relatively young, and maybe that stage is still kind of, maybe that is still the case, but how do you manage to protect against competitors who might perceive value in creating a similar offering?
Woo, love this question. And that's a question that comes back very often when you fundraise, right? VCs love asking this question. The reality, the no BS answer is, when you're starting a company, it's just an idea, right? So anyone can copy your idea. And so it's very hard to, you know, when you raise a pre-seed round to say, well, I'm going to be different because this and that, and I'm going to compete against Apple and I'm going to beat them because ABCD, right? That's a little bit naive as an approach. However, there are several things that we do at Kento to help us sort of build that moat. One is our partnership with Mayo Clinic. So we're small, but we have a big name attached to our brand, which gives a lot of credibility and firepower in terms of conversations and door openers. And that's one. Number two, we try to deploy a solution where it's a big market, but very underserved. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of solutions that prevent heart disease. Great. That's not what we do. What we do is management, right? So we take your patients from the day they get a heart disease until, well, today we don't cure it, so end of life. And there's not a lot of solutions that do that because there's not a lot of people who understand the mechanics of technology, cardiology, and how to bolt on AI on top of that. And this sort of blending of our personal experience with some great AI folks we work with, or some great cardiologists, is really what brings the magic together. And in the words of a lot of our big hospital clients, there's no solution out there, you know, that can take a patient with an evidence-based program and sort of deliver these health outcomes, right? And that's really what we're bringing, is the medical credibility, rigor to our product that a lot of big players out there don't necessarily bring. So again, anyone throwing $100 million to replicate Kento could sort of build the same or something similar, but we haven't seen that happen yet. So we're hopeful we'll get big enough to avoid that.
And just before moving on to the mentorship segment, I'd like to end the business segment by asking you guys, where do you think Kento will be in 5 years and what do you hope it will have achieved?
Mike, you want to? No? Okay.
I'm more than happy to, but I mean, go for it.
Well, okay, I'll go crazy, then you bring us back down to earth. So in 5 years, it is likely that Kento will be at least on three continents, because we're already going to be on two early next year. So that's an easy one. But in a perfect world, we think about it in terms of impact, right? How many lives are we, or how many people living with heart disease are we improving? Are we helping getting better? So it's not necessarily about financial revenue. Are we going to be a unicorn? Like, we're not playing this game for now. We want to build an impact. We're building an impact that is obviously financially sound, because we don't want to build, you know, a company that loses money indefinitely. Mind you, there are a couple of business cases that you could argue still did it and raised $100 million doing it, but that's not what we're going to do. But yeah, it's really in terms of impact. So how many people who today don't have any other option will benefit from our solution. Look at geographies like China, India. People are dying from heart disease like crazy. There's really no solution, and access to care is really poor, right? We're bringing a digital solution that can help us live longer and probably live much better. And that's how we look at where Kento is gonna be. If there's money on top of that, if we make a ton of revenue, if we raise $200 million, great. But it's not the primary thing we're looking at today.
Yeah, exactly. Just to sum up Max's point, and it's the same, we share a vision on this one. It's really any patient in the world who is suffering from a cardiovascular disease or is extremely at high risk, right? We don't need to wait for you to have a heart attack to help you, which is not the case right now. Now it's you have a heart attack and we could barely even help you. So essentially, any patient that would need the support would be able to have the support that anywhere. That's how I would define success in 5 years for Kento.
Now, if we start in the mentorship segment, how should a student that wants to pursue entrepreneurship or young adults go about founding a business?
Well, yeah, I'll give my view on this one. Maybe it's a bit different than Max's view, but I think it's definitely great to to it's definitely great to want to found a business, fully support it. However, my view is I think certain students should focus on really gaining as much experience as possible in their first few years post-university, okay? I think it will be extremely helpful once you do decide to have to launch a business and you have that business idea that you want to roll with. One, you'll have a much better network just overall, right, in the business field or whatever field you're pursuing. Two, you'll have probably a better network as well to determine who a good co-founder would be, because maybe you'll have worked with that person for many, many years before, etc. And you'll just have a better understanding and much more experience, right? Like if I had to, I don't know, negotiate a partnership just coming out of HEC versus negotiating a partnership today after, you know, many years of experience, it's not the same ballpark, right? So or same with fundraising, or same with a transaction. I mean, on my end, that's how I see it. So I would focus earlier on really building as much experience as possible. If you're making money off of this too, even better, right? It's like a double win, but I would even sacrifice a higher paying job for a job where you get more experience. For example, you know, if you do think that you want to join, you want to start a business and you want it to maybe potentially take a VC route, well, maybe find a startup that you can join and see how, you know, you'll learn so much in that startup, or join, going to consulting and gain experience working in different sectors, different projects, and maybe you'll get some ideas there. But that's kind of how I see it, right? Like build your foundation first, and then I think it would better help you build a business afterwards. Max, I don't know if you see it differently, potentially.
No, I mean, such words you say, suck it up, right? And what I mean by suck it up is build a foundation, as Mike said. You don't need 10 years to build a foundation, but like get exposed early on to what a startup is. If you can be hired by a small startup, just forget about your 100K that you were promised when you joined your business school, suck it up, right? Go work where the experience will matter to you, or do a spin consulting. If you're good enough to get into, you know, on top consulting firms, I strongly advise that you do that and develop your work ethics, your network, and everything else. But your critical thinking, unless you're an absolute genius with a crazy software idea that's going to solve a world problem, it's very unlikely that right out of school you'll build out a successful company. And you look at the stats, right? If you look at successful founders, generally they're more, you know, 30, 40, 50 or even, you're old when they start their business, the most successful business. So stats are against you, so suck it up, spend a few years building your foundations and what it looks like to build a startup. To Mike's point, being exposed to, you know, tough early days of a startup, this kind of stress, this kind of build up, you know, selecting the tools, the people, seeing what works, having to hire and fire, like you need this kind of exposure before you start your business, right? Very important.
And before we conclude the episodes, do you have any last words for our audience?
Yeah, I do. Just be bold. I think when I look back on my background, the things that I didn't want to do was personal barriers, right? So it was always me putting myself some barriers, not being ambitious enough, not willing to call Mayo Clinic and say, hey, we're building that. Do you guys want to build it with us? Like the worst you can have is a no, but in our case, we had a yes. So it's just a mindset, like break doors and go for it. It's never a wrong decision to be bold.
Yeah, and just to continue what Max is saying, like I completely agree with the be bold. I think it's someone's tagline though. I'm not sure if it's trademarked or not, but hopefully it's not. But all this to say, be bold, I agree. And one of the things that I'm personally always asking myself is, if I don't do A, B, or C, will I regret it later on? And I want to have as little regrets as possible later on, right? And for example, you know, starting Kento, is this something that I will regret if I don't do? Absolutely yes. So let's go for it, and we're gonna go all in, right? Same thing with leaving a Fortune 10 company to join a little Montreal startup with barely 10 employees. Will I regret it later on if I don't do it? Yes. So all these things, right? Like be bold, try to minimize regrets. You need to take some risks in life, you know, try to take the ones that you'll regret the least later on, and that will, you know, you'll have great stories to tell later on as well.
Thank you so much to both of you guys. Max, Mike, it was a pleasure to have you both on a podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
You guys.
Thanks for listening to the episode. If you enjoyed the show, Don't hesitate to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Take care and see you next time.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management, or any other field of financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for your given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support, endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive properties. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.